Welcome to The Green Docs. This is a podcast that talks about the latest in women's and family health and how these are impacted by the environment. Here's everything your OB probably isn't telling you, but should be.
So, for example, electric vehicle sales are down, but not necessarily out. When you're picking your next car for your family, could hybrid be the real future?
Location, location, location. Redfin, a national realty company, now provides air pollution data for their home listings.
And new research from the London School of Business has some updates for ESG investing. That's environment, social, and governance. The recommendation is for these practices to divest from divestment. However, there's a new tilt for a better direction.
I'm Bruce.
And I'm Nate. We're two OBGYNs who care about the environment and how it affects our patients. So in 2020, we published the first paper about climate change and pregnancy in a top medical journal.
It had tables and everything. The day the paper came out, the New York Times wrote about our findings. And 10 hours later, Joe Biden tweeted at us.
Then a bunch of other things happened. So now, like everybody else, we've got a podcast.
Welcome to the Green Docs.
In this episode, we're joining forces with FIGO. That's the International Federation of Gynecology and Obstetrics, basically like the United Nations, but for OBGYNs. We're joining with this group to bring you a special Earth Day episode. We're going to be hearing from voices all around the globe, like Dr. Ditas Dasena from the Philippines, Dr. Jim Zhang from China, an expert in PFAS research, and Rashmi Joglekar from the University of California, San Francisco, with a dedicated team on reproductive health and the environment. They're going to be talking about what Earth Day means to them and what in the world it has to do with women's and family health. I'm one of your co-hosts, Nate DiNicola. I'm the environmental health expert for that international group called FIGO, as well as our national OBGYN society, and I'm a private practice OBGYN and chief medical officer.
And I'm Bruce Bacar. I'm an OBGYN in San Diego in the second phase of my career, where I do work at the intersection of climate and health, and I work with nonprofits and teach health professionals about the importance of advocacy around climate change and health impacts. So, Nate, it's been a little while. You've been extra busy. Can you catch me up?
Well, I'm more looking forward at this point, because you're right, it's been a little while. And in fact, it's been 1 year since our trip to New Orleans. Kendall and I are headed there this weekend. It's our anniversary already, and we'll see if we can recreate a second line.
It sounds like this is something you don't need an excuse to do, but your first anniversary is a great excuse. Do you have any special plans?
I mean, New Orleans is a special city. So yeah, there's always things. I mean, we've got French Quarter Fest, which was part of the reason we planned our wedding that weekend last year in the first place. It is, among locals, I think one of the best weekends in the year for New Orleans. You get all the best local artists playing in, I mean, dozens of stages around town. Essentially, it's a mini jazz fest, and it's all free. You really can't beat it. So we'll see that again. There's some great acts. And, you know, we've got tentatively a trip planned to Avery Island, which does that mean anything to you or kind of jog any bells?
Never heard of it. What is it?
Avery Island is the home and birthplace of Tabasco hot sauce.
Ah, that Avery Island.
That Avery Island. Are
you going to get an extra large quart bottle of this stuff, or what do you do?
No, I go mini. I go mini with these things. I used to put them in my pockets and have them in the car. And I used to have Tabasco, like, literally just on me everywhere when I lived in New Orleans. So I hear there's a tour that's pretty cool. The town kind of around it is New Iberia, which is a place that I actually never got to spend much time in Louisiana when I was living there, but heard really good things. So I think we've got some cool stuff around there. In addition to liking Tabasco hot sauce, I just love their back label because there's three ingredients: vinegar, red pepper, salt, in that order. And the byline on it, often imitated, never duplicated, Tabasco hot sauce. I think at one point we discussed that as a byline for our podcast. All right, Bruce, so that's what's new with us. What's new with you? What are you up to?
It's kind of perfect for one of the headlines we'll be talking about, but my Tesla took me to the cleaners last week.
Did it charge you a lot of money? Is that what?
No, it took me to the cleaners, and then a little while later, it took me to a clothing store, and shortly after that, it brought me home.
Did it buy you dinner, too?
I haven't gotten that far. But I actually had been listening just the day before this all happened to a podcast called Electrek, which is all about electric vehicles. And they were talking about how Tesla had a plan to roll out a free month of full self-driving to anyone who had a recent model Tesla. And so the very next day, I got an email message saying that my car was now capable of driving itself for a month for free. And I've just been reading about full self-driving and all the problems they've had and all the different iterations. This is version 12 of the software. And I wouldn't say I'm an expert on this by any means. It's a huge technological morass I'm not at all well informed of. But the bottom line is this has been in development a long time. It's still not perfect, but it's a simply amazing thing. So I enabled the full self-driving and pulled out of my driveway and put in the address for the dry cleaners and hit go, which is basically just pushing the button on the steering wheel, the scroll wheel, and it drove me to the cleaners. And I have to tell you, the first time you have your hands off of any of the pedals and the steering yoke in a car and it begins to negotiate, not just stopping and starting in a line, but turning on its own, stopping at lights, going around bicyclists. It was an otherworldly experience, and it was absolutely terrifying and thrilling at the same time. And I'm pleased to report that no one died, and I didn't hit anything, and I made it home safely. I've used it half a dozen times since then, but it's an amazing technological feat, even though it's still not perfect.
That's a good bar for our updates to include. Nobody died. I'm glad we still can clear that one. Okay, so what seat were you sitting in when Tesla was driving you around on your date?
Oh, you still have to monitor the system closely. It comes complete with a long list of precautions and things to look out for. It's not a relaxing experience, to be honest, to have the car drive itself, at least initially. It is really kind of freaky to see how it's very, very much aware of its surroundings. It's very cautious. It pulls slowly up to a stop sign. And it's as though it's looking around for at least as long as I would, if not longer, before it decides to go forward.
Did you have any close calls? Anything you were like about to hit the brakes on?
I don't have the best depth perception in the world because I have an imbalance in my eyesight. So I'm always kind of cautious and I probably drive a little closer to the center of the lane instead of over to the right side. But while I was passing by a bunch of cars a few times parked along the side of the road, I was worried that we were too close, but I decided to let the system do its thing, and it was fine. So actually, I think in some ways, it's a better driver than I am already. But two of us together are what's needed to truly make it safe. And I just have to say, we shouldn't be complaining about the imperfections. It's an amazing thing that they've done, and it's taken them years and years to get it this far. It's pretty darn good already.
Well, no, it's really tapped into your kind of driving intentions when it just takes you straight to Torrey Pines and orders a drink for you.
That's the next version. It'll use AI and it'll know what I want before I even know what I want and take me there. That's probably coming.
Okay, so that might get people to buy electric cars if it knows you better than you and takes you where you want to go. All right, so we talk a lot about electric cars on this podcast. I think because we're overall getting to the idea that there are problems for our health when it comes to air pollution. And so the less anybody can breathe air with air pollution in it, especially for women who are getting pregnant or pregnant moms, the better. And this is one way that we can approach that. What did you take about this headline, that electric vehicle sales have declined, especially in Europe over the last quarter in particular, but it looks like the last year was trending that direction?
Well, first of all, I think it's really premature to say that this is a significant downward trend. I want to be really clear about it. It's for multiple reasons. I think electric vehicles are going to continue to grow as a percentage of sales and percentage of cars that we see on the road, not the least of which is it's not simply that it's better for our health in an immediate way, but the burning of fossil fuels in the transportation sector makes up, I think, about 30% of greenhouse gas emissions around the world, and it's something that has to change. But I think the other two main reasons why electric vehicle sales are not going to really reverse, I think this is a slowing which is in some ways really expected because there was an initial surge of early adoption and people that are what they were calling EV curious that just always wanted to see what an electric car would be like and were probably past that initial wave of sales, it was premature to think that those sales rates were just going to continue to accelerate. But I think the other two reasons that are going to drive EV sales going forward are, first of all, the driving experience is simply way better than an internal combustion car. It's so much quicker and smoother and quieter. I used to call this every Mercedes owner's wet dream. They're just wonderful to drive. But the other thing that's really important about these cars, aside from the health benefits and the climate necessity of us changing away from fossil fuels, are that these cars are far simpler technically. They have so many fewer parts that have to be replaced or that can break or that can go wrong at any point in time. So it's not only a better driving experience, it's coming from a much cleaner and simpler vehicle. So I think it's really, this headline is a not headline to me. It's just that the initial phase of EV euphoria has worn off. And now we're getting down to the reality. But I have to tell you, Nate, have you met anybody that has an electric car that was unhappy with
the decision? Right here, me. Yeah, I don't like them. I totally see why this article happened. I definitely agree with the points that fossil fuels are a problem that needs to be solved. And the automotive sector is a big part of that. But first of all, you know, I'm not an automotive expert. I have a few cars that I love and I have an interest in cars, but I'm no expert. But I was at the point of buying a new car not long ago. And Kendall just got a new car also. And, you know, the advantages that were promised are not quite there yet. Even in big urban centers like here in Southern California, where I previously lived in D.C., the ability to quickly charge the car is nowhere near what the comparison for gasoline refilling is. And we were doing a road trip from DC to Baltimore and back toward the end. First of all, you kind of know, like in gas cars, in older cars, that the gas gauge will maybe rapidly fall at the end. But for the most part, in a newer typical gas car, you can trust the gas gauge. In the EV, we went from like, it's supposed to be 10 miles of range to 3 miles in a split second. And so if we went to 10 to 3 that quick, we know it can drop to zero just as fast. There was no charging station available. The closest one was like 8 miles away, and this is in DC. And we were returning a car that was rented through Turo. And so there's a time limit on it, and we were going to be like an hour late if we had to go do that charge. You know, when the article cites things like, The infrastructure is not there yet. I totally get it. And I think if we're, you know, if we're talking about this as a health benefit and people should take an interest in it, I think this is where, you know, it's almost like if you have any way to encourage your city to have more charging stations, like that would help. So anyway, you said, have I ever met anybody? Yeah, me. That was one problem, the range and the infrastructure limitations. So I think there is a bright future still for these, but there's some serious solutions that need to be put in.
Well, the charging infrastructure is being addressed by the Inflation Reduction Act, so I think that's going to ramp up pretty rapidly. There are some inconveniences, but I think the benefits, short-term and long-term, really outweigh them. These stories about range anxiety and lack of charging infrastructure only affect people if they're driving hundreds of miles to a destination and back. Most people have, like I have a dryer plug in my garage that I have my Tesla plugged into whenever I need a charge, and it charges overnight like my cell phone. I have never run out of range in 12 years of driving an electric car. It's an adjustment, but it's one I'm happy to make because I think it's important to do it.
Well, it works for you and it works for some people. My brother has a purely electric vehicle and he drives around Southern California, LA to Orange County. It works for him. But it doesn't on a road trip. Like if they're going to the desert, they can't use it. The purpose, I think, for our perspective here is people who are in a place of deciding about a new car and considering family health may very genuinely want to either do their part to their community and have less air pollution, or might just be thinking about like what's the best decision for my family, financially and otherwise. And I can see where the hybrid has a lot of appeal. Like that's what I personally use. I am able to charge it in some places, but even in Orange County, I can't charge it at my work locations. And I think, you know, acknowledging the non-ideological, very like practical limitations to it will be relevant to helping people get to where they want to go, which is a, I think, more affordable and safer and healthier driving experience. Anyway, I was not at all surprised by the headline. I think the complaints are genuine. And I think the goal is still important that we've talked about. So yeah, my hope would be that these systemic infrastructure and pricing are taken very seriously by community leaders and that they build it out because it is a hindrance right now.
My prediction is we will continue to see sales that are strong, that are motivated by all these different factors that we're talking about, and people will learn to make adjustments for them that are becoming progressively easier as price continues to be less and less of a barrier. So we'll just have to stay tuned. But in the meantime, let's talk about another area where the air quality is being understood and shared. And this is this story about this Seattle-based real estate listing company, Redfin. And I think in a sign of the times, they're no longer on their website listings just touting school districts for people considering buying a house, but they are now including information about air quality with their home listings. And with Redfin, this is in addition to data about fire and heat and wind and even flood risk. And they include projections of what air quality is likely to be with time going forward. They use a third-party climate risk data provider, which is a real thing now helping businesses make projections. And Nate, you might be interested to know that the air pollutants that they measure are old friends, ozone and fine particulate matter, which lots of studies, including ours, have shown has a very strong indication is hazardous to birth outcomes. And certainly there's lots and lots of data to show that these types of air pollutants figure in childhood asthma and in heart disease, lung problems, and even cancer. So I think it's a good thing, but unfortunately, what it really means is we're not doing a good enough job reversing these air pollution trends.
I think this was a positive story, and it really gives families some useful information. The studies that we reviewed in our systematic review, we're typically looking at zip code data. So it was not specific to your house. And really, more than your zip code, you want to know what your personal exposure is on a daily basis. You know, are you in that group that gets a lot of extra ozone and PM2.5 in the air you breathe and therefore have the risk for, you know, for pregnancy, things like low birth weight, preterm birth, outside of pregnancy, things like heart disease, asthma, all these reasons to avoid air pollution. As we've pointed out before, it's called air pollution. Like, we've always known this was a problem. It's not something you would not eat food pollution or drink water pollution. So I think it's a really positive step that families can now factor this in to not just the zip code or the county, but that specific home, because there are factors that are much more regional, you know, location to highways, the other kind of heavy trafficked areas around a certain district, even drive times, you know, could affect the air in a certain area. I mean, even better than this, which some companies are experimenting with, would be like a personal wearable that would measure your individual PM2.5, ozone, other pollution exposure. And maybe that's, you know, next in a different kind of version of marketing to families. But yeah, I thought this was cool. I think people who criticize companies for greenwashing would have no problem with this.
Yeah, and they are using third-party data to make these assessments, and they're empowering people. From my reading, more and more families are concerned about air pollution exposure as, you know, I think they should be. So we'll have to see where this goes. But my guess is they won't be the only ones providing this data before long.
Did you ever have any patients ask you about air pollution in a home purchase discussion?
No.
Patients weren't asking you about where to buy their houses?
No.
Side hustle is real estate agent.
So do you?
Yeah, it's been a handful of times. Maybe like, I don't know, a couple dozen times. And it usually was in a city where there was known to be kind of one concentrated area of air pollution. So like in when I was at Penn in Philadelphia, there was a part of the city that had a major power plant with a lot of air pollution concentrated right around it. And they were considering, this couple who was expecting their first child, a home that was in the city and kind of near that plant versus one in the suburbs that was quite distant from it. And they had seen an article saying, you know, this kind of thing we're talking about, air pollution, birth outcomes, childhood asthma, all those things could be a problem. So they were asking me as their doctor if I knew anything about it. Basically, was the story real? Is it something they really should consider? Even at the time, prior to the publication of our review, there was enough data out there that I could say, you know, very honestly, yes, you're right to think about this. And, you know, there is a proximity factor. Like the closer you are to concentrated air pollution, the worse it is. Unfortunately, air pollution is one of those things that doesn't know perfect boundaries. You know, like so air pollution in Philadelphia can get to New Jersey and can get to Delaware and China. Air pollution can get to the United States. Like it's not like it's confined, but it is concentrated. So yeah, there have been a number of times people ask about that. And I kind of hope that it's, I don't hope that people are coming to their doctors for advice about real estate as a new thing that we're consulting on. But I do hope the message is out there that there's these health bits of information they can factor into their all their lifestyle choices.
That's right. So tell me about divesting from divestment.
Yeah, I really like this article. Have you encountered the approach of divestment at all in your work, either in San Diego or consulting roles?
Personally, I have asked my Schwab advisor to get me out of fossil fuel companies and tobacco companies and firearm companies. I'm sure none of that is a surprise to you. I've done some reading about ESG investing. I know that this sector has been really a positive one for returns. And the funds that I have, socially responsible so-called funds, have been performing really well for me the past several years.
Yeah, so I thought you might have some experience with this. And from past guests, we've heard that this is a viable strategy. Without getting into specifics of the societies that I work at and the way the board and discussions go, this topic comes up. Like this comes up at many institutions. You know, should we divest? If so, how is it? And again, there's always kind of like this interest in the having the right sentiment to not further fuel these fossil fuels that we need to be scaling down. But combined with modern and realistic approaches of like, does it really do anything? And what was interesting about this article, which by the way, you know, London School of Business, this was not kind of like amateur opinions. These were economists with data behind them, was that, you know, you have to kind of consider the factors in a market. And as a doctor, I'm not an expert in this, and reading an article will not get me there. But I brought it up here because I think, you know, a lot of people in their workplace might encounter this topic. And it might seem like it's remote, but more and more, I think it's kind of hitting home or hitting at work, at least. The crux of the article was that if you're favoring divestment, it really is not the most effective strategy. Because number one, in order for the investors to sell something, to divest, that's what that means, to sell an asset, they have to find a buyer. So someone's buying it. It's not a boycott where the alternative is nobody buys the product. In this case, you have to sell it to somebody. So it's not like it's going to plummet their capital. The other thing is that it doesn't really incentivize the companies to do corrective measures. If you just kind of carte blanche across the board, don't invest in any, say, fossil fuel companies, then you won't end up giving money or incentivizing the companies who do develop renewable energies. And that's the kind of thing that a lot of economists point to say that it actually is better. Like it'd be better to get more companies to adopt more renewable strategies while still receiving funds than to just basically kind of take them out of the equation because they're still getting capital. Like they might have a slight drop in share price over time, but they're still getting the capital one way or the other. So what do you think about that?
Well, I think there's some logic to that. To do a blanket divestment, I think in certain industries, certain products, I would favor this, but in others, I can see the point. I think if you talk about tobacco companies, I don't think there's an avenue for them to go, at least not one I've ever heard of, where they're going to make a product that's safe for people in any way. By the same token, the fossil fuel companies have been guilty of greenwashing many, many times over many years, and I have basically zero confidence in them when they talk about investing in renewable energy. That doesn't mean that it's entirely accurate. And if you do close your eyes to an entire sector, you're going to miss those companies that maybe are breaking the mold and doing things differently and figuring, you know, the writing is on the wall and they have to change. But what that also requires in picking companies like that that you won't divest from is that you have to have confidence in your research and not be fooled by an industry that has had a long time pattern of obscuring the dangers of their products. So I would be very suspicious of any actions from a fossil fuel company that actually made it sound like they were starting to do the right thing because they've lied so many times to us. But I think it's also important for us to keep our eyes open and see whether or not the change is happening in industries like that. And it is also true, I think, that the more that not just you and I divest, but when university systems that buy massive amounts of these stocks divest from these sectors, it does have a significant impact on share price. I'm by no means an expert investor, but when you're buying hundreds and hundreds of thousands of shares or selling them and dumping them on the market, it is going to have a significant impact on their available capital. So again, not a black and white answer to your question.
Well, this article would say that that's not true. It doesn't
Which part?
Capital. The part where if they dump them on the market, the only way it works is if somebody buys it. So the capital's still there. It doesn't grow as rapidly. They can't expand as much. But again, it's not a boycott. I think it'll be obvious for anybody listening to this who has any background in economics or investment or anything. We are not investment bankers. We are not. I at least am not going to claim any expertise in this whatsoever. But I just think it's interesting. Like past guests have said, these conversations often come up, and you can do your part by speaking up in whatever kind of level of leadership you're engaged in your community. And I absolutely favor doctors and scientists to be pillars of their community and be more prominent in leadership. And so I think the message that I'm at least trying to communicate is to pause and to consider that there are better and worse ways to achieve the goal of corrective action and of the, get the ding bell ready, of the externalities of the fossil fuels, right? Because because creating energy by itself is not a problem, right? It's the externality of the fossil fuel industry that it creates air pollution and a dozen other things that are bad for the environment. But creating energy is not bad. So if they can find ways to create energy that don't have those negative externalities, then that can be incentivized. And divestment doesn't do that, at least according to the experts, which I am not one of them, but I do, take stock in trusting experts. So anyway, this is mostly for people who find themselves in boardrooms of any shape or size, considering the topic, you might look a little deeper and find something that is more beneficial.
And I can sign on to that. I don't have a problem with that approach. I think it's not, as in many things, the most simple black and white answers are often missing some important points. So cautiously, I'll agree.
Yeah, blunt force only works well in like cartoons. We get the birds around the head. It's hilarious. It's great every time. Okay, so let's talk about the next half of the show. We're really excited to be able to cross-collaborate with FIGO, the International OBGYN Society, as I said, basically the United Nations for our field. We're upcoming next, you're going to hear the Earth Day podcast episode that I am hosting for them as their chair on it's called the Committee for Toxic Environmental Exposures and Climate Change. I know, an awesome, easy-to-remember thing, but we affectionately call it the T2T2. And that will feature guests from the Philippines, Dr. Ditas de Sena, who has done amazing work in what's called teaching the teachers or training the trainees, basically training people who then go out and train other people on how to connect climate and health messages. We'll be talking to Dr. Jim Zhang, who is a global expert on PFAS, a topic that we haven't talked nearly enough about on this podcast in the first two seasons, but he's going to give us a good, healthy, unavoidable here, a healthy dose of PFAS education. And then Rashmi from University of California, San Francisco, she is part of the numerous kind of institutes that are at UCSF specifically devoted to this intersection of reproductive health and toxic exposures. And she's part of a group led by Dr. Tracy Woodruff, who are international leaders and really doing cool things to bring public messaging in an accessible way. So they create infographics, they tell stories. Looking forward to hearing what she has to share.
We'll be right back with those interviews.
Greetings, people of Earth. I've always wanted to start to talk that way. Welcome to the FIGO Earth Day podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Nate DiNicola. I'm an OBGYN in Southern California and the chair of FIGO's Committee on Climate Change and Toxic Environmental Exposures. You may affectionately hear us refer to us as the C2T2. We're a new committee, so you may not be familiar with all of our work, and we wanted to take this opportunity on Earth Day to share what we're working on this year and what you can look forward to coming out of our committee work. We have, in the past, FIGO has published a document back in 2015 as a broad overview of how the environment connects to women's health. And it's a very kind of broad overview. It includes things in obstetrics and gynecology everything from toxic chemicals related to impaired brain development, things like ADHD and autism, to risk for gynecologic cancer like uterine and breast cancer. But in the almost 10 years now since that document was published, many new findings and scientific consensus has come about. And so our committee work will largely focus on updating those recommendations to bring more clinical guidance and more specific patient encounters that we can help guide our global audience through. So we're taking this opportunity on Earth Day to interview a number of people who are on the committee or helping the committee with our work, and basically shine a lens on what you can look forward to. It's worth noting the history of Earth Day here. It began back in 1970 in Arleigh, Virginia, basically as a college sit-in, educational sit-in. In fact, the date, April 22nd, was picked because it sat right between spring break and finals. Now, if you believe astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson, the origins of Earth Day really go back a few years prior to the NASA Apollo missions to the moon, where once the astronauts got to the moon, they turned around and looked at Earth and in effect saw Earth for the first time, at least as a whole. And that picture of Earthrise coming over the lunar landscape on the cover of Time magazine really is what drove a lot of this interest in treating Earth as a whole. But either way, you know, whatever the origins of the history are, after Earth Day 1970, there was a large focus on environmental policies and eco-conservation. This is where things like, at least the United States, Clean Water Act, Clean Air Act developed. The Environmental Protection Agency was formed as a result of this. There was a global effort to move toward unleaded gas, to stop using the catalytic converter. The verdict for the Minamata Bay victims of mercury poisoning was reached in 1973, and the group Doctors Without Borders was formed not long after. By the 1990s, Earth Day had become a global event, and in that spirit, we are now very much Doctors Without Borders, getting together here to share some educational information with you to a global audience. As we face what looks like kind of a new wave of eco-conservation and scientifically informed policy on things like toxic chemicals, especially things that are hormone-disrupting chemicals, like PFAS, for example. The fact that there's plastic everywhere, and we have to contend with this in the food we eat, the water we drink, plastics being found in placentas and in breast milk, and it has hormone disruption, so we have to counter that. In fact, the Earth Day theme this year is the planet versus plastics. There are things you might be familiar with, like organic diet, and does it really work? And a kind of a new wave of clean beauty products and clean beauty advertising, some of which labels, you know, really might not be that useful, but others are. So to walk us through all these, we're really excited to talk to three different members of our committee and people work with our committee. We have Dr. Ditas Tasena, the prior chair of this committee, the C2T2, professor in the Philippines, where she has done amazing work in training the trainees, basically building a whole cadre of medical students, residents, and engaged community members to not only learn about environmental activism, but to bring it to their nodes of influence and create a whole team working on this. We'll be talking to Professor Jim Zhang out of China, who's done groundbreaking research on PFAS, and he will tell us kind of the fact and fiction and if it can be avoided. I'll be talking to Rashmi Juglekar from the University of California, San Francisco. They have a well-known program on reproductive health and the environment. They were instrumental in helping FIGO write the first document back in 2015, and they will once again be assisting us with our communication coming in for, you know, the upcoming revision. And Rashmi has done really amazing work in engaging communities to kind of help foster the message of avoiding toxic environmental things, either chemicals or outdoor exposures, and, you know, bringing it to a kind of real level in terms of policy education. So stay tuned for these three interviews. Up first, we'll be speaking with Dr. Ditas Tasena. So we are delighted now to be joined by Dr. Ditas Tasena from the Philippines. Welcome, Dr. Tasena. How are you feeling?
Hi. Thank you, Nate. Thank you for the invite for this podcast that we're doing.
Yeah, this historic podcast. This is the first FIGO Earth Day podcast ever. Can you believe that?
So that's why it's great.
Yeah, although I guess a lot of things are the first ever nowadays. That doesn't mean a whole lot necessarily. But, you know, I wear this watch now that tells me the time anywhere in the world since doing more work with FIGO. And it tells me it's 10 p.m. in Manila. You look very bright and earthy and done up for 10 p.m.
Yeah, I know. Well, I like to look good. But, you know, right now, the weather in the Philippines is really bad. We have temperatures almost at 44 degrees centigrade. And I hope you can convert that for me in Fahrenheit. But I'm pretty sure it might be, what, 80s or 90s or something.
Yeah.
So we're really feeling the summer right now in the Philippines, which started about a few days ago.
Yeah, I'm not going to do the math here on air, but it's roughly times yeah. times 9/5, which, yeah, it comes out to, I think, low 90s yes. for that. So definitely on the warmer side. Well, so we want to, you know, at 7 a.m. here, I'm in California, so it's kind of cool in a way that we can talk all around the globe. And that's kind of the idea of having expertise in our committee like this, which you were chair of recently and very accomplished in your tenure there. You know, this is for all of the FIGO audience. So some people will be very familiar with environmental drivers of women's health. Some people may be tuning in for the first time to hear about it. What do you tell people when you describe the committee that you chaired for the last session?
Really, the past couple of years was very challenging. You were with us when we started in 2015 in Vancouver. And it was really an eye-opener for many of us. So when I have my audience, particularly, well, zeroing in and focusing on my patients, Nate, on being in the OBGYN field, and mostly my practice is a balance both of obstetrics and gynecology, I would tell them and point out to them a couple of diseases, especially when they're pregnant, and I tell them, you know what, experiences have shown me recently, now that I'm almost 35 years, can you believe that, Nate, in my OBGYN practice?
I thought you meant you're almost 35 years old. That's...
Oh, yeah. Thank you very much for that. But truly, it's been 35 years, and I tell them, you know, used to be I would not hear my patients talk about their children having ADHD or neurodevelopmental problems. And then they would tell me, right now, doctor, my youngest child has just recently been diagnosed with ADHD. So that becomes a very good signal for me. And I tell them, you know, this is what's happening. Now, research and even medicine has found out that diseases are not primarily now genetically oriented. And that the environment has many things to do with it. And especially now that you're pregnant again, we have to really look at your lifestyle and look at your exposures. Since I was honed in with our FIGO committee more on the environmental toxins than climate change, I would tell them really the impact of the food you eat, the diet, the chemicals that you're exposed to. Of course, with the chemicals, it becomes difficult on her part and my part. And simply stating the more common things that they might be familiar with, like mercury and lead, and how mercury really has been shown to affect neurodevelopmental problems. And, you know, like we're in Asia, Nate, no? And Filipinos do eat a lot of fish. We have a lot of sources of fish, and we do it like raw way of eating Japanese sashimi. So pointing it towards that end, it becomes a bit easier for them to understand and on my side too, to explain. And although, as I tell my colleagues, you know, you really have to sacrifice a bit your time to share. And then what I do easily, Nate, you know, because people are now so Google savvy, and they even would like to go first to Google, then
that's
to
right. Dr. Descent. That's right. Dr. Google is
so
on call.
I would scribble the word. So I would scribble the note. You know, we don't have much time, but we can talk about it again. But you have to try and Google this. I would put EDCs on my prescription pad and say, why don't you try to read more on endocrine disrupting chemicals? So that's how I do the jumping board for my conversation with my patients. And right now with my colleagues, it has become easy because we've really conducted a lot of lectures and webinars for them. And, you know, the Philippines is made up of 7,100 or more islands with about 12 regions, so we've gone through almost the whole country at this point.
Well, so it sounds like one of the most common clinical aspects you talk about is diet and nutrition related to pregnancy and then birth outcomes. And it is interesting that while we recognize that neurodevelopmental brain development conditions are on the rise, I think everyone pretty much acknowledges that. The cause is not, I don't think, as widely understood to be strongly influenced by the environment. You know, we don't think that our genetics have changed much in the last, say, decade or more, but we've noticed the rise of this. And sure, you can say that we've become, as a medical discipline across the globe, better at identifying, diagnosing, and offering treatments earlier. But that can't possibly explain going from, you know, a condition that used to be one in hundreds to now one in dozens, mm-hmm. or even one in six. I've seen some estimates. So it sounds like you can talk to patients in a very real, practical way about ADHD, autism, and environmental potential links to those, ways to avoid them. Do people appreciate and understand the link to diet, and especially where you are, the seafood they consume, the way it, you know, both the heavy metal consumption of the fish, where they're in the food chain, and whether it's raw or not?
Yeah, I think they do. What's nice with our patients is that they are more, well, I would say the education bit is there. And because of the social media, I think there is more exposure to them right now, Nate. So it really becomes very easy to them. And the way I would comprehend, and, you know, after our consultation, it seems they grasp the idea, but hopefully they would follow it because they would say, oh, is that so, doctor? Then I would say, yes. So you really should try and watch out what you eat. And I know, you know, always economy is a problem. So I tell them, you know, you can go basically with your green leafy vegetables, but be sure to really wash them well so that even the chemicals, you know, the farmers uses a lot of your pesticides and herbicides, you can really be able to wash them. So I think giving them varied options and way how to really go through their nutrition in a very practical way, I do think they appreciate it and they're able to grasp it. And particularly emphasizing on my part, you know, I always tell them processed food, canned foods, you know, again, because of economy, some might choose just to buy a can of sardines or something in exchange for more fresh fish, you know. So I would tell them, be careful, you know, the cans also have chemicals. They may have either the phthalates or other chemicals. So they would try to comprehend and say, oh, okay, doctor, if that's what you think. And they would really try to minimize all these things and try to go more. I would try to shy away, Nate, from using organic because the concept in the Philippines, and I think globally, when it's organic, it's more expensive, but it doesn't really need to be that expensive. I mean, could be homegrown. And so right now, we see a lot of advocates for urban gardening. That helps a lot. And so I would just tell them, you know, you don't really need to buy expensive vegetables. You can grow your own green leafy vegetables, even in pots, because right now, most people are really living in condominiums or tall buildings mm-hmm. where there's not much
yeah.
space.
Yeah, it is the same basically in the United States in that the organic label typically carries with it a pretty hefty price tag. Now, not always, but a lot of times, a lot of times it does. At least in the United States, it's a government program. Mm-hmm. So the full name of it is USDA Organic. And of all the labels on food, it actually is a decent one. It does assure and certify that there's, say, much fewer pesticides or no pesticides and fewer chemicals. So you are getting some benefit from it, but it tends to cost more. And there, you know, if you're looking for the ultimate endpoint, which is typically fewer pesticides, which are hormone-disrupting chemicals and create those autism, ADHD risk, then, I mean, talking about things that are, say, locally grown, buy local, buy fresh, mm-hmm. would often get you the same place, maybe sparing the price tag.
Agree on
so
that.
I'm really curious about this idea of prescribing patients Google searches. Do you, I think it's brilliant. Do you prescribe, do you direct them to websites also? Do you have any specific ones that like, you know, maybe not Google, maybe go to this website and look at the fish you're going to eat this week?
I think, Nate, I have to learn more websites at this point. Perhaps linking with my residents will do that. But it's so easy. What I just give them really would be the term. And I would say, look at climate change, look at EDC, look at chemicals. And it's easy. And I think, you know, particularly now, most of my patients are also still young and they're very techie savvy. So I don't see any difficulty because when I tell them that, Nate, they will just nod their mm-hmm. head. and say, okay, doctor, we look for it.
Well, because you're always ahead of the curve. And this is really, I think, insightful, you know, because a lot of doctors are hesitant to have patients use Google as a resource because they come in and it's not always bad, but it isn't always good either. And we have to, like, you know, de-Google patients for half the visit before we even get to the real part. But I think this is a really savvy and tech in touch way to just on your prescription pad, write the search terms. You know, what's interesting, Kendall and I were at dinner recently looking at seafood options, and there was a fish, like the special of the day was from Hawaii. It was an Onaka fish. And I didn't know what that was. And I was trying to see if it would be okay, heavy metal wise. I got to be honest, it took me a while to find a website that I could trust. And you know which one I found that I ended up liking the best? Wikipedia.
What?
Wikipedia had a pretty decent list.
Wikipedia. Okay.
This might be US focused for the maybe it's US focused for the web page that I found, but it took our government assessment of fish in a table and converted it into a much more user-friendly form. The government table was very technical and dry. Wikipedia took the same information, essentially, and just color-coded it, you know, and made the heavy metal fish, the fish highest heavy metals in, like, dark color, and the safest ones in lighter color, and literally the ones that are in the gray zone in shades of gray. And Onaka ended up being similar to snapper, which is kind of right in the middle of the food chain, so it was kind of
thank you for that information. I mean, that's going to help me.
Yeah.
And I'll try to look into that website.
So yeah, curious if what you think about it. It passed the sniff test for me. Okay. Well, I also wanted to ask you.
I think it's a cool lady.
We talk about medical topics quite a bit because we have clinicians who are going to be listening to this and they're taking care of patients, and we're hoping to give them something they can use like the next day in clinic. I think we've given them some direction for how to counsel about a specific thing about, you know, say heavy metals or hormone disrupting chemicals that could be in the food supply and therefore could affect pregnancy. So hopefully kind of mission accomplished there. We give them one nugget of information. Yeah. I do want to talk a little bit about the moment that we're celebrating here, which is Earth Day. At least for myself, for most of my life, I would say this probably was not an event for me. I didn't really pay much attention to it. There's so many holidays nowadays. It's hard to, you know, kind of know which ones to focus on unless there's something specific to you personally. But since doing work in this, Earth Day has become, I'd say, more important to myself. Does Earth Day mean anything to you on a regular basis? Do you celebrate it in any way? Do you do anything special?
I'm so proud to tell you that once we've started on the advocacy, like 2015, the fire has really caught up. And I don't know our government. I think there's a lot of just talk on it. But at least now you hear it on the media about really focusing on the environment. And currently, as I've sat from the past president of our society and with FIGO, now all our regions are doing tree planting activities, Nate. Can you believe that? It's part of their project. And right now, this Earth Day, all the 12 chapters are doing tree planting. And in fact, you wouldn't believe it, one chapter has been so inspired that they want to move a law into our government that for every child that is born, a tree should be planted. Because, you know, right now, even our mountains, they're also denuded because of, you know, lots of mining activity. So, it really very inspirational. And at the same time, even our current president now, right now, as I told you in our last meeting, we now have a campaign for this Earth Day, which is no to single-use plastics. You know that I was really shocked when I saw the statistics that the Philippines is the third country globally. I couldn't remember the exact figure of how much weight of plastic waste do we produce and donate to the world, no? But we're number three.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in our little way, if we'll be able to minimize the use of all these plastics, it will really be great. And hopefully save water pollution, save plastic contamination that could be a very great risk to the health of our country at least.
Yeah,
point.
That's such a cool program to tie the birth of a child to the birth of a new plant. There's that phrase that we hear a lot in our work now where they say the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The next best time is today.
That's some really amazing initiatives that you and your government are working on. You know, when I was in Israel a few years ago for a conference, we were traveling between Tel Aviv mm-hmm. and Jerusalem, and you're there. I mean, it's the desert. You know, I mean, it certainly is not like a lush landscape. But in between those two cities mm-hmm. was just nothing but greenery, and maybe I wouldn't call it a forest, but it was all trees and wooded, and it did not look like much of the surrounding area. And our tour guide was explaining that mm-hmm. they, you know, generations ago, they just started planting trees, and it you know, it takes time, but faster than you might think, mm-hmm. you start to reap the benefits of that.
Yes. And
it sounds like the Philippines is very on board and taking advantage of that.
Yeah. So we hope, you know, like our mango trees, we're so proud of our mango fruits. I hope you've tasted some of them. I know they have it in Costco.
Well, I want to now.
The dried mangoes. The fresh mangoes are better, so I should invite you here, Nate. But truly, you know, if you just plant a mango tree, I'm sure our country will benefit much, you know, not only with the cool air from the tree, but even getting much income from the mango fruit itself. So I should invite you one time and with your wife so you could enjoy our fresh mangoes here, not the ones dried mangoes in Costco.
I would love that. And tell you what, I'm going to find a mango somewhere on Earth Day to honor the Philippines and okay. maybe a mango smoothie or something.
Okay, thank you, Nate, for that.
All right, so...
We have green and yellow mangoes.
I don't know if I've ever seen a green mango. Well, you mean so it's not ripe yet? Or when you eat it, it's green?
It's not yet ripe. It's not yet ripe, but it's the sourness in it gives it a different flavor.
Right. We're gonna need some mango education for Figo for our next statement. I think we're gonna have some different mango options. Okay, so this has been so fun. I'm about to wrap up because we want to, you know, kind of show the whole global perspective. So we'll be talking to people from all over the world. But, you know, to bring it back to our FIGO committee work so people can know what to look forward to, what are you looking forward to in our work over the next, say, leading into the World Congress next year in South Africa?
Basically, I do hope that, you know, it might be difficult, but I guess we really have to embark again, Nate, on some research, particularly probably looking at the regional differences in terms of exposures of the women. And perhaps we in FIGO can really have a global impact in terms of a lot of legislation and political drive. Because, you know, as doctors, we have our clout, we have our own influence, but I guess, again, we always emphasize the collaboration. So I think with FIGO in the nucleus of everything, we hope we'll be able to, you know, really be able to collaborate and expand more on our program, ending up with a lot of legislation, research, and making people realize we really have to do something for the environment, something for Mother Earth, particularly for the next generation. So as you put it, a tree can easily grow. It's never too late. I think the answer is let's do it now. So that's my vision for our work in FIGO.
Well, I know you've been so influential in the Philippines, both in terms of medical trainee education and legislator education. So we're really so lucky to have you on our committee still and feeling, you know, really strong leadership coming to kind of carry the torch. Well, thank you so much, Ditas, and really look forward to maybe we can make this one tree per child a global thing. Maybe more governments can take this on, or more hospitals can. That would not be the worst thing to have as a FIGO legacy.
Thank you, Nate, and it's always nice working with you. And really, our partnerships, we really learn a lot. So thank you, and more power to the group. Thank you.
All right.
Happy Earth Day.
Yeah, happy Earth Day, and we'll enjoy some mangoes.
Okay. Okay.
Welcome back. So we continue our world tour talking to experts from FIGO's C2T2 committee, and we're really delighted to be joined by Professor Jim Zhang from the Shanghai Jiao Tong University in Shanghai. Jim, thanks for staying up late with us.
Thank you for the interview.
We really want to talk about a topic that is, I think, on a lot of clinicians and a lot of patients' radar, but maybe they don't know all the details. They just know that they've heard about this topic, and that is PFAS in women's health. So to set the stage for people, can you tell us what is PFAS and what people should know about where they might encounter it in the world?
The full name of PFAS is per- or polyfluoroalkyl substances. These are chemicals that are man-made and cannot be found in the natural environment. These chemicals have very appealing features, though. They are lipophobic and hydrophobic, so they make daily products resistant to the stains, grease, and water. So they are commonly used in non-sticky cookware, carpets, waterproof clothing, food packaging, firefighting materials, and even cosmetics. However, those chemicals in recent years have been found they are reproductive toxic. They also have the liver toxicity, immunotoxicity, neurotoxicity, and even carcinogenicity. Therefore, international societies are very much aware of these and concerned about these chemicals. These chemicals are called forever chemicals because they are not found in the natural environment. Every ounce of these chemicals made by human will be circulated in the globe, so they will stay there forever. That makes people very concerned.
Yeah, the forever chemical is definitely, I think, the scary part about these, because a lot of people can probably think back to a time when they owned a nonstick pan or presume they ate food that was cooked in a nonstick pan. Do we have any information about what kind of dosage is necessary to create the toxic effect?
Well, our research, and as well as other people's research, found that actually in the very low environmental lab exposure level, which is a nanogram per liter, that kind of level of exposure has a biological effect that can be observed. So for example, in women's and children's health, and particularly these are the susceptible population, before pregnancy, during pregnancy, for the fetus and for young children, the dose doesn't have to be very high to have an impact. For example, our research showed that among women who are preparing for pregnancy, those environmental level of PFAS can affect their menstrual cycle, endocrine or hormone levels, and prolong the time to pregnancy, even increase the risk of infertility. And we also found that in our research that these chemicals are associated with polycystic ovary syndrome, which is a very common gynecological disorder, endocrine disorders. In a sense that environmental dose can have an impact.
Now, in your experience, is this something that women can ask to be tested for? If they come to their clinician and say, I'm concerned I have PCOS, or I'm concerned I'm having trouble conceiving, I've heard that these environmental toxics could be a factor. Is there testing available for this kind of thing?
Yes. Women can be tested in the blood, and there are many labs. Many of them are not in a clinical lab, but more research lab. It can test these chemicals. So perhaps these concerned women can approach some research lab or in some approach way to get tested and see whether in their blood level these chemicals level are high.
Yeah, and clinically, I think a lot of people encounter this question of fertility, unexplained infertility. And to some degree, I think we have to assume a certain amount of exposure from modern living. If, say, the testing isn't done, but women just know that there has in the past been some, especially if a small dose can potentially be biologically active, they might assume, okay, I've encountered this in the past. What can they do? How can they, I mean, I know they're called forever chemicals, so removing them could be difficult, but if they want to improve their chances of getting pregnant or improve the health of their current pregnancy, what advice can we give them?
Unfortunately, at this moment, there's no treatment to get rid of these chemicals. And also, it's very unfortunate that women who are pregnant, they can pass these chemicals to the fetus, to the offspring, and through the breastfeeding. In a sense that a woman during pregnancy or through pregnancy and also through menstruation they may get rid of some of these capillaries, but through pregnancy, they will give it to the offspring. Also, PFAS is a very large group, and there's perhaps several thousands of PFAS categories. Some of them have a long, very long half-life, for example, 5 or 8 years. Those half-life very long. They can stay in the body for a very long time. And some of them have a short half-life. They only stay in the body for several days. For these very long PFAS, it's tough.
In your research, were you tracking patients over time to see if their levels changed, if they had some of these short half-life exposures that maybe wouldn't be as lifelong for health detriment?
The legacy PFAS or old PFAS usually have a long half-life. But gradually, people recognize these legacy PFAS are more toxic. Therefore, newer emerging PFAS replacements have been made. And those replacements, many of them, tend to be shorter half-life. But people often perhaps think of short half-life is less toxic, not necessarily. We found that short half-life does not necessarily, it's less toxic. So that's one of the areas that our research is focusing on those new emerging PFAS, these replacements, how they might have impact on the production, on our thyroid hormones, endocrine system, and in some carcinogenesis. So that's kind of like our new focus.
For some people hearing this who might think, well, everything is toxic. There's always some risk to these things. Can you talk a little more about how we have learned about PFAS connected to certain conditions in OBGYN? I'll start with the GYN side. What is it about PFAS specifically that creates the risk for something like polycystic ovarian syndrome?
There are possibly two biological mechanisms. One is endocrine disruption. So like PFAS is considered as one of the endocrine disruptors. So they can affect, for example, thyroid hormones, the estrogens or androgens levels, or LH or FSH, these hormones related to reproduction. There's also another mechanism is oxidative stress. These chemicals enter the liver, enter the cells, they increase oxidative stress in another way to affect, for example, the ovary, quality of ovaries, or even affect the sperm. So these are perhaps the main possible biological mechanisms.
So clinicians who are becoming more familiar with this term of endocrine disrupting chemicals or hormone disrupting chemicals, which are really a broad range of environmental exposures. And, they could be in plasticizers, they can be a lot of cosmetics and personal care products beyond the PFAS. For clinicians who are getting more just experience and comfort counseling about this, they could adapt that counseling to include PFAS and direct patients toward avoidance. Is that kind of a fair categorization to group those together?
Yes. Each chemicals have different sources. In order to reduce the exposure, I think we have to go to the source. And one is trying to find a replacement, reduce the production, release, and the contamination, reduce the contamination to prevent the exposure, human exposure. But in reality, at the moment, we cannot totally get rid of PFAS. That will affect too much of daily products and world finance or industry. So we have to live with it. But we can try individually. We can try to avoid or reduce the exposure. For example, when we know that the waterproof clothing is one source. So especially for children, the school uniforms often use the waterproof clothing. So if we can try to use non-waterproof coats for school uniform, that's one way to reduce exposure. And also food packaging. For example, when the pizza is delivered, there's a paper, at the bottom of the pizza. I mean, some of these packaging, food packaging, contains PFAS. So if we reduce these kind of exposure, that's also a reduced exposure. And the other is, if you're planning to be pregnant or during pregnancy, perhaps trying to reduce cosmetics use, because in the cosmetics, we can detect these chemicals. So these kind of things may help. The cookware, we don't use non-sticky cookware, we use the iron, the traditional cookware, may also reduce exposure.
Yeah. Who would have thought that one of the least healthy parts about pizza could be the packaging? I think people usually worry about the cheese and the cholesterol. For women who are pregnant or thinking about getting pregnant, can you talk a little bit about the mechanism for that and the outcomes we worry about? Is it the same endocrine disruption, or is there something else as well?
The PFAS, the effect of PFAS, you know, through different mechanisms, and it could affect the final phase is the reproduction, get pregnancy. But there's, you know, different ways to affect the pregnancy, that to achieve the pregnancy. PFAS is one of the chemicals that, as I mentioned before, these approaches, maybe we can reduce PFAS. But different chemicals have a different exposure sources. And so there are other things, for example, like BPA or these also plastic the materials, they are also endocrine disruptors. They probably, you are using the plastic bottles is a source of exposure. So that may be also be avoided or try to reduce.
Yeah, not to frighten our audiences, but it's true. I mean, if you start looking at the group of hormone disrupting chemicals beyond PFAS and you start including BPA, you start including the pesticides, it does seem like we're just, everywhere we look, there's something. But it sounds like that we could direct people to nonstick pans. That's something as a start, that we could look very carefully at food packaging, not only the grease resistant and waterproof options for packaging, but also avoiding plastic and especially heating things in plastic. That seems to be a consistent message to avoid the endocrine disrupting chemicals. When it comes to the personal care products, are there any labels that people can look for that are slightly more reassuring? I know that in the past we've directed patients to be cautious about unscented, because that will often just mean there's a lot of scents added to things to cancel the scent out, and it might almost be worse. So things like fragrance-free are typically preferred. Are there certain labels related to PFAS in particular that people can look for?
Not what I'm aware of. So a lot of time those cosmetics doesn't really have very clear label of these all the materials they use in the proper cosmetics. And that's some things that perhaps the regulations can get improved.
Yeah, well, that's kind of where I was going with this, was that there's only so much a mom can do. I mean, she's already watching very closely the food she eats. She's already being told a list of do's and don'ts, mostly don'ts for things that are, you know, commonly part of diet. She will not be consuming alcohol. She's not going to be smoking. It's hard for her to then think about the manufacturing process for common cosmetic goods or common food products. Are you aware of or in touch with any kind of regulatory efforts to protect consumers and protect pregnant women from these things?
Yes, I think we, as a scientist, we try first to provide evidence to the policymakers and as much as we can to do public education. And also actually, in a way, educate the policymakers to put these toxic chemicals into the regulation process. And so that probably is the most important contribution that we can do to reduce the exposure. But at the same time, we also should advocate for trying to find replacement alternatives and also the waste management. Because all these waste chemicals, if you have a better technology, perhaps you can reduce the amount of chemicals circulating in the world.
And the replacement becomes critical, because we run the risk of what we've experienced in the past with regrettable substitution, where BPA, for example, bisphenol A, is replaced by very similarly active
bisphenol C and bisphenol S and a whole alphabet soup of similar chemicals that very likely have the same biological activity of disrupting hormones and creating all the health problems you discussed. It sounds like that has to be part of the education to policymakers, is that it's not enough just to say, don't use this chemical. The replacement has to be tested as well. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yes. And in the literature, right, we know that the scientific evidence is always lag behind the production and application of these chemicals. So among all these PFAS, for example, those well-known or established ones are only tip of the iceberg. Many, many more emerging chemicals are not yet well tested. Their toxicity are not well recognized. So I think first for the government or the regulators, they should encourage to do more research, especially on these emerging chemicals, PFAS. So once these more evidence is available, new regulations should be set up. So I also want to say is that, you know, in that aspect, United States has taken the lead in the past 10, 20 years. U.S. EPA has done a great job, established this horizontal water standard, list all the things people can do, advocate. But in many countries in the world, there's no regulation either, and not much public education. And the waste, the production of PFAS, the waste management are far away from what has been done in the U.S. So I think that there's a long way to go for the world to be safe.
Well, a really poignant point to bring up there, especially as we are celebrating and acknowledging Earth Day, because when that began in 1970, a whole host of environmental protections followed. You know, in the United States, we had things like the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act. You mentioned the Environmental Protection Agency that was founded on the heels of Earth Day. And that's why we're so fortunate to have people like you on our global leadership team here in Women's Health, because in an increasingly globalized world, what happens in China affects what happens in America, and what happens in South America affects Europe and Africa. We need voices like yours to be reaching people really everywhere. So we're so glad to have this podcast, and you're joining us to help communicate that message. On that note, just kind of on a personal side, do you do anything different on Earth Day, or do you celebrate Earth Day? What does Earth Day mean to you?
I'm actually heading the Center for Children's Environmental Health. So that's, you know, environment is one of the major work, research we do. And so, yes, we will come up with some just public education materials, particularly like a PFAS. Even though the name of the center is Children's Environmental Health, but we actually do maternal and child health. Particularly nowadays, we know early life exposure is quite important issue. So we come up with these pamphlets, public education materials, and on PFAS and the woman's reproductive health, pregnancy outcomes, and the child health on these issues. So we hope that that can reach more people.
Well, it sounds like a strong step forward in the right direction. To wrap up here, last question, since we are highlighting the work that our committee does for the international OBGYN community, what are you looking forward to in your term here with our specific committee on environmental health? We have a few years ahead of us. Anything you're excited about?
One is, first, I would like to continue to work on PFAS. Two new directions. One is focusing on new and emerging PFAS. And second is to cover broader aspect of women's health, how PFAS affects other, you know, many other women's health. That probably are the amount of work ahead.
Yes, well, you're the man to do it, and we're so fortunate to have you on our team and to stay up late with us tonight and spend some time getting this message across the world. So thanks so much, Jim, and from FIGO, happy Earth Day.
Okay, thank you, Nate.
So welcome back. Our next interview is one that I'm really excited to share. We're speaking with Reshmi Joglekar from the University of California, San Francisco. She works with a team of scientists and researchers
in Program for Reproductive Health and the Environment. And specifically, she now leads a new division there called the Earth Center, perfectly themed for Earth Day. Rashmi, welcome to the FIGO podcast.
Hi, Nate. Thank you so much. Thank you so much for having me.
And you've got your green on today for Earth Day. We feel very Earth-centered right now.
Yes, that was intentional.
So maybe can you tell us a little bit about what the Earth Center is? Because I think our audience might be familiar with CSF and their robust division that helped produce, that kind of introduced this whole drivers of women's health. But a lot has changed in 10 years, and this Earth Center sounds like it's part of that.
The Earth Center at UCSF, the Earth is actually an acronym that stands for Environmental Research and Translation for Health. And our mission is to solve the growing burden of chemical disease by accelerating the pace of identifying and preventing harmful environmental exposures. And these are exposures that undermine health, reproduction, and human development. So at the Earth Center, I am now the director of the Community Engagement Corps. And the mission of the Community Engagement Corps is to drive transformational systems-level changes in healthcare education, in clinical care, and in policies that lead to improved health and reduced health inequities.
What are some favorite projects that you're either working on right now or have introduced recently?
The Community Engagement Corps within the Earth Center has several really exciting initiatives that we've already developed and are expanding in several ways in the coming years. One program that we've been running for the past 5 years is the Environmental Scholars Program. And this is a program that connects medical and nursing professional students with research mentors and community organizations to conduct community-relevant research. And in the past, that's resulted in, you know, thousands of hours of mentorship and in 5 peer-reviewed publications. We're excited to continue that work forward, and we now have a new community pilot award that will actually pay a stipend to the researcher and to the community organization to conduct meaningful work. Another program that we're really excited about is the Reach the Decision Makers program. This is actually a program that pre-started way back in 2010, and we have revamped and relaunched with the Earth Center now, has taken ownership of this program. It connects clinicians, scientists, and community advocates to decision makers at California EPA. And the goal is to inform this group of these interdisciplinary teams to try to formulate a policy-relevant issue and advocate those issues to California EPA decision makers. And the ultimate goal is to strengthen public health policies that promote health equity.
Well, perfect tie-in for our Earth Day episode. People might be aware, we've reviewed it a few times on this podcast, but Earth Day really was what helped create the Environmental Protection Agency and the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act. Kind of a whole host of policies came off of that interest in looking at the Earth more as a whole rather than, you know, kind of siloed countries. Fantastic tie-in that now there's, you know, state-by-state divisions that are really, I think in California's case, you know, kind of leading the way and shining a light for the country. So when it went to, you know, what the audience specifically might be thinking about, if they've, say, read the document from 2015, we know people maybe don't read the whole document, but then let's look at the tables and they see things, you know, like chemicals that are in certain categories, either phthalates or some version of endocrine disruption might be connected to a neural developmental delay, ADHD, autism. Like that, that's one thing that's in our table. What kind of things should the audience who care about women's health be looking for? You know, what are the new topics? What are you excited to share with us that we can help put in the new updated guidance?
Yeah, so I think, you know, there have been some major scientific developments since the previous version, and notably, several high-powered evidence evaluations or systematic reviews have been released that just underscore our understanding of how toxic chemicals are impacting reproductive health and neurodevelopment. This includes systematic reviews on phthalates and how they contribute to preterm birth. This includes systematic reviews on PFAS and how PFAS exposures contribute to low birth weight. And another kind of finding that's coming out of these high-powered evidence evaluations is the understanding that these chemicals can act synergistically and they can contribute to common adverse health outcomes, which kind of underscores the need for cumulative risk assessment. We also now have a better understanding of non-chemical stressors that increase susceptibility to harm for things like reproductive health and neurodevelopmental harm. And the, you know, the growing understanding now that risk assessment, especially when conducted by regulatory agencies needs to take all of that into account. It needs to take into account the non-chemical stressors that are enhancing susceptibility. It needs to take into account the multiple chemical exposures that people encounter on a daily basis. We're not encountering one PFAS and one phthalate every day. We're encountering dozens of those chemicals and other chemical categories on a daily basis. So really translating that into decision-making is kind of the key moving forward. But we now have a lot of evidence to support that.
So it sounds like some of the same topics may reemerge, but now with a lot more weight behind them. That if we want to say, you know, exposure to phthalates that are, yes, out there in personal care products, in some food packaging, that in the past that might have been highlighted as potential risk, but now we really have a robust amount of evidence to say, we know enough to act. This is something to be avoided. It's not really theoretical that this is like a known risk factor.
Exactly. And the more evidence that mounts, the more number of these high-powered systematic reviews that are published, the more confidence we have in those findings, and the more reason to take action.
You mentioned the non-chemical stressors, and it sounds like there's a lot of education to be done around that. What are some examples of non-chemical stressors that you guys are working on?
Non-chemical stressors kind of collectively enhance an individual's susceptibility to harm, which means that they can experience more harm from chemical exposures than someone who's not experiencing non-chemical stressors. They can be separated into two categories. So we like to think of them as intrinsic susceptibility factors, which are things that are more inherent to an individual, like their sex and their genetic makeup. There are also extrinsic susceptibility factors that are not inherent to an individual. These are things like experiencing psychosocial stress from racial discrimination or poor access to healthy foods, inadequate access to healthcare, experiencing violence, all of these factors that could, again, in combination or individually, enhance someone's susceptibility to harm from chemical exposures.
So it sounds like a similar theme that was identified in, that there was an article by team where I was at shortly after residency in DC, where a lot of the personal care products, things like hair straighteners, some deodorants, were, you know, really loaded with phthalates and hormone disrupting chemicals. And, you know, the community was likely experiencing some of the stressors you mentioned. So it's kind of a compound hit, and it makes that risk factor even stronger. Is that the kind of thing that you're focusing on?
Exactly. That's exactly right. And at UCS, we're actually now trying to understand, through systematic review, what the magnitude of difference is that an individual can experience if they are exposed to non-chemical stressors versus not exposed. Having that kind of quantifiable metric is something that we're hoping to figure out and then also translate to regulatory agencies. So it's represented in things like chemical risk assessment.
Let's say somebody's listening to this and they think, okay, I'm convinced I want to look for a better option for my, you know, next purchase, my next, say, beauty product, or I want to look into clean beauty, but they know there's a lot of, not going to say lying to consumers, but a lot of misdirection, a lot of you know, marketing campaigns that may not really have science behind them. Are there any labels or ways to inspect labels that we can direct people to?
One tool that I personally love is the Environmental Working Group Skin Deep database. This is actually now even translated into an app version, but it's available online. You can type in any consumer or actually any personal care product that you use. And scientists at EWG have formulated a toxicity or hazard score. And they've explained, you know, how those scores have been developed, what they mean, and the chemicals that are found in these products and the hazards associated with them. I've found this tool to be incredibly useful in just my own transition to clean beauty products and clean personal care products. I will say there's also an element of difficulty in really being able to purchase clean products. It's a little bit of a misnomer because the labeling laws don't actually allow for, you know, companies to disclose the ingredients, every ingredient in these products. So there are systems level changes that actually need to happen in order for us to truly be able to make informed decisions when we're purchasing these types of products. At the moment, you can rely on tools like the Skin Deep database I mentioned from EWG, but until these systems level changes happen, we're really not going to be able to make fully informed decisions about our health.
Yeah, the Environmental Working Group, EWG, has been such a valuable resource for a long time. The peer-reviewed literature or the society recommendations, they certainly were informing, you know, these lists of chemicals to avoid with their dirty dust list and other things like Skin Deep. So that's a fantastic resource, and it's right there on people's phones. They can access it. They would have internet access. Love that recommendation. Thanks, Rashmi. On the note of kind of needing to go higher for a lot of these interventions, because there's only so much that a mom can do, only so much that people can do to avoid these things. And as you pointed out, there's some government barriers even to transparency. That's kind of what Earth Day is all about, at least in my experience, that this is, you know, science creating policy with a maybe a bit of kumbaya behind it, but that's what drove a lot of the origins. Do you acknowledge or celebrate Earth Day at all? Like what does Earth Day mean to you?
This is going to sound pretty cliche, but I think every day is Earth Day. And I'm glad that Earth Day exists because it brings attention to the public about the importance of preserving our planet, preserving, you know, wildlife, preserving natural spaces, and ultimately preserving human health and protecting human health. But because of the focus of my career, I consider every day Earth Day.
Well, not a bad soundbite to leave our audience with. So thanks so much, Rashmi, for joining us to not only talk on this podcast and share some coming trends and insights, but also for lending your valuable expertise to our FIGO team as we update the documents that hopefully will serve everybody well for another 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me, Nate. And I am so excited to partake in updating these documents and just finding more and more ways to make sure that the science is represented in decision-making and in public health policy.
All right. Thanks, Rashmi.
Well, from this distant vantage point, those were three very informative interviews. Distant vantage point, by the way, a reference to Carl Sagan's Pale Blue Dot. If you do nothing else this Earth Day, I'd recommend going watching his 3-minute video essay on what it meant for the Voyager to turn back and take a picture of Earth all the way from out at the rings of Saturn. Thanks for listening to our FIGO C2T2 podcast on Earth Day. There will be more FIGO podcasts like this in the future. We're excited to share some of these newer options. Along those lines, our committee, in addition to taking on the work of revising the committee opinion, will be addressing more current, we call them hot topics, in short form video and shorter written work. Now, these hot topics will be things that largely you may have seen in the news. For example, the rise of cancer in young adults, prominently with actress Olivia Munn and Kate Middleton. We'll also be taking on topics about how changing weather patterns are affecting the incidence of vector-borne illness in many countries and continents, Africa and South America, prime among them. We'll be talking about how, for example, rising sea level is introducing new amounts of salt in the aquifers in places like Bangladesh and throughout India, creating a new risk factor for preeclampsia. Stay tuned for all of that. Thank you for tuning in, and look forward to seeing everybody in South Africa next year to share, you know, a lot of our work there. And for everybody else, happy Earth Day. Well, hope you enjoyed that global tour of medical experts for our FIGO podcast. Kind of felt like where in the world is Carmen Sandiego? Where's our next FIGO guest going to be from? We have people from all over the world, from China, Philippines, and then right here at home in the United States. In addition to hearing their medical expertise and their scientific expertise, which, you know, is the foundation of our health messaging, I personally was really curious to hear kind of on the personal side what people were going to be doing on Earth Day, if anything at all, and kind of how they got into this topic. It occurs to me, Bruce, we haven't asked you about that yet. What does Earth Day mean to you? Do you do anything? Last year, we had our get-together in Balboa Park in San Diego. Got to have your shoe very near my face. But I'm glad that's not becoming an annual tradition. We're not repeating this year. What else does Earth Day mean to you?
Every year, it's different. Fact of the matter is, the work that I'm doing now, connecting climate change to health, is all about Earth. It's all about nature. I live where I live, in a small place, in a precious spot, because nature is so incredible here by the water. Every year, Earth Day takes on somewhat of a different circumstance. This time, I'm giving a presentation for a nursing organization that's putting on a conference in San Diego. And so I'll be hanging out with a bunch of academics and movers and shakers in the environmental world. And so I'm really looking forward to this Earth Day, but I enjoy every one of them. How about you?
You know, I'd say for most of my life, I really didn't stop to acknowledge Earth Day as a separate holiday, not of any kind of protest or anything. I didn't really kind of focus on it. And this was at a time, by the way, when there only were, say, 10 or 12 featured holidays a year. You know, it's not like it is now where I think literally every day you could Google something and find, you know, a new day. Like, I think today is National Pet Day. I got an ad from Target saying you should go shopping for your pet today. You know, what it means to me in more kind of present time is that it is one of the days I do acknowledge, not only obviously for work on this, but personally, I do take some stock of it. I've always enjoyed nature growing up in California, and even on trips outside of California, my dad would take us on rafting trips and hikes and going to the ocean, going to the mountains. So nature's always been certainly something to, appreciated. Now, what it means for me, honestly, is a time to stop. And at least, I do think everyone should do this once a year, at least, is watch Carl Sagan's short video, Pale Blue Dot. Like, if I were in charge of educational programming at some level of, you know, county school districts, like, I would make that a mandatory Earth Day assignment. You spend 3 minutes and you watch that video. It's like a pledge of allegiance to humanity and to our planet. That's basically what it means to me now, is a check-in there and a pledge of allegiance to those things. So, do we have some fast facts to recap our second annual Earth Day episode?
Yes, Dr. DeSena talked about using Google and using the internet to get medical information. And it's certainly something that people have done for years now. But let's just talk briefly about how to get reliable medical information. So there are a number of sources. We've talked about not only Google, but also Wikipedia and the how to tell if the fish that you're thinking about eating is safe during pregnancy. But questions to ask: who owns the website and why are they sharing this information? Who actually wrote the information you're reading, and was it reviewed by experts or created by experts? And then finally, is it current? Does it need to be updated? Because as we've all seen, medical information is changing at a pace never seen before right now. How about you? Do you have a fast fact?
I love what you just said. That might be my favorite fast fact so far, to be honest. For this episode, fast fact number two, PFAS exposure, also one of the forever chemicals. Women who are exposed to this do have a higher rate of cancer, high blood pressure, and giving birth to low birth weight babies. Now, as we learned from Dr. Zhang, there are a lot of studies behind these linkages, but also ways to avoid them. Simple things we can talk about in a recap: switching from nonstick pans, being sure not to heat up food that is in grease-resistant packaging, and when it's movie night and you're going to make some popcorn, make it on the stovetop.
And fast fact number three, the very first Earth Day, and we talked about this a year ago in our Earth Day episode, was April 22nd in 1970, which was a date chosen because it fell conveniently between spring break and finals. And this unassuming celebration led to major changes in how the U.S. functions and really how the world looks at our delicate planet. And specifically with the U.S., the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency and the passage of the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act. And April 22nd is also National Jelly Bean Day. So let's not forget how important that is.
All right. Well, we've got to do a mocktail of the jelly beans then. This is our new assignment. How I
missed
that. Can't
wait to see what you come up with. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm embarrassed. I didn't know that already. I think of butterscotch or you know, you could probably combine some jelly beans. You know, I think it's worth people going back and listening to that episode. I think it was episode 3 in season 1, where we really broke down the history. It's really cool. I mean, if you listen to astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson break it down, you can basically say that Earth Day maybe began with the end of the Vietnam War and the United States' interest in protecting the ultimate high ground, which was then outer space, because Russia was sending Sputnik and they needed to control high ground. So they went to the moon. Not really for exploration, but for military defense. Now, once they got there and turned around and looked back, they saw Earth perhaps the first time at that scale. And from that, we saw a whole bunch of, ding bell again, these externalities of seeing the Earth differently and protecting it differently and building laws around it. We can't ignore Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring, was also part of this movement. So a really cool history. We go into more detail in that last episode, but the more I learn about Earth Day, the more I get fascinated by its history. From Neil deGrasse Tyson to jelly beans.
And it was started by a fairly small number of people with the best of intentions. And it reminds us of Margaret Mead's quote, which is, "Never doubt that a few individuals can change the world. In fact, it's the only thing that ever has." I love our planet. I don't want to go live on any other planets. I have yet to see any good surfing happening on Mars or the moon or any other place. I'm sticking around, and I would like to make this place as good as we can make it.
Not going to let your Tesla do self-driving you to Mars? Because that's what's coming.
He does have one up in space, typical of his sense of humor. But no, let's stay here and make the most of this planet, and let's all do our part. Happy Earth Day, Nate.
Yeah, happy Earth Day.
Stay tuned for our Mother's Day episode of Green Docs, and be sure to subscribe so you don't miss it. Find us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your listening content, or stop by our website, greendocspodcast.com, where you can check out the show notes and links for this episode. You can send us comments, good or bad, questions, no question is bad, and join our growing email list for the latest Green Docs news and special offers.
This Earth Day episode of Green Docs was created by Bruce Picard and Nate DiNicola, and produced by Podcast 411. Special thanks to all of our guests from FIGO and UCSF. Go check out our website, greendocspodcast.com. If you like this podcast and want to help it grow the way those trees grow, give us reviews, Spotify, Apple, wherever you stream content. We'll be back again for the Mother's episode. Check us out every other Thursday for a new episode of Green Docs.